Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge with you tonight on the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And you can find this at the website NASCA.org. That's NAASCA.org. And tonight, a special guest night, and we'll bring our special guest on in a minute. But I have Penelope, my co-host, and I'm asking her if she would be willing to read our mission here at NASCA and to give out the phone number for people to come onto the panel to interact with our special guest.
Oh, thank you, Pamela.
Penelope.
Thank you. I'd love to. So please call in and support our very special guest, Jennifer, this evening. The number to do so is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that number is 646-595-2118. And I will greet you on the back line and bring you into the show. But NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, is all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with two goals: educating the public on childhood abuse, especially as a way to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone, and the second, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So one last time, the number to call in is area code 646-595-2118 to support our special guest, Jennifer. Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you, Penelope. So we're going to bring our special guest on, but I want to read just a little bit about her bio. Her name is Jennifer Michelle from Walker, Louisiana, and we're a fellow Louisianian because I'm from Louisiana, Miss Pamela. And she says in her bio that her parents married long after she was born. Her mom joined the service and left her in her father's care, and nobody knew that she even left for boot camp. And during her time away, her mother was away, she was left in an apartment without supervision. Somebody called her grandmother, and because they heard the baby crying, and that was Jennifer, and sent them to rescue Jennifer. So you can see that she already started off with a very rough life. Her parents divorced, and later her birth father left her at the doorstep for the last time, never coming back. And since he remarried and started a new family when she was about 5. So we're going to stop there, and we're going to ask Jennifer to come on and just let her know that we're all here to support her, validate her, believe her story, and help her know that she doesn't need to be nervous, even though this is a, whenever you tell your story, it's pretty visceral. The emotions will come up. We can't help that as survivors. But Jennifer, you're on,
yep.
And you have the mic, and so we're going to let you start from your earliest years and tell us a bit again about your family.
Yes, ma'am. And thank you for having me. my mom was around 18, and I guess my dad was like 18, 19 when they married. And like you said, from my bio, I was born not too long after they married. I don't think she was pregnant when they got married, but either way, when I was months old, like young infant, she joined the service. She left, didn't tell anybody in her side of the family. They found me in the apartment alone, in my own filth and nothing to eat. And my grandfather took me back with him. And basically, I pretty much lived with them until I was 7. They were more or less my domiciliary guardian. Not in a legal way, but just in a, you know, they had me way. But my mom, even when she came back, she didn't really, she was not exactly mom of the year. She would, she left me at my grandparents still, even when she was back. You know, she'd come and have visitation with me as if it was a divorce situation. You know, just kind of, it was like I remember more little pieces of her when I was really young, but not in a good way. It was like she would put me on shows as if, oh, look at my beautiful daughter, and oh, I love her so much, and, you know, isn't she precious? But then we got behind closed doors, it was like I didn't exist. And I was always super glad to be back home with my grandparents, because there, and my grandparents I stayed with, it was her parents. But when I was with them, you know, I got nothing but just this pure love, and they doted on me constantly, as grandparents will. I have grandkids of my own, and I do that, but with them, it was almost like they were doing everything they could to fill that void and yet fill the role of being a parent, too. But, you know, she would come and visit with me. She would take me to her apartment sometimes, but it was like I didn't have good memories. Even when my dad came, he basically remarried quickly after they divorced, and he married a woman that had a child of her own. And it was like I was the third wheel when I was over there. So I was invisible there, too, because basically I just remember the whole time wishing to hurry up and go home. And, you know, I was literally just the third wheel there, and nobody paid attention to me, and my dad acted like I didn't exist. And, you know, as in my bio, when I was around 5, I vividly remember him and my mother getting this huge argument and her saying that she was going to, you know, she was never going to let him see me again. And next thing I know, you know, they quit screaming, turned separate ways, and I'm standing on the doorstep just watching him walk away, and he never turns around to hug me goodbye, tell me goodbye, no waves, no I love you, just kept walking. And I remember standing there thinking, he forgot to acknowledge me. And that particular moment stuck with me for the longest time, because I think I always waited for him to turn around and come back. From there, my mom, she just, and, you know, go ahead.
What age did he leave you? Did you say it was 5 years old?
I was 5 years old.
That's a very, that's a very predominant age as far as development.
Right.
And,
right.
Yes. And so that brought up probably abandonment issues your whole life.
Correct. Very much so. And I didn't even realize That was a huge issue for me. You know, several years ago, early in therapy, you know, me and my husband got in this huge argument, and it was all because I would get in this habit with people in general, whether it was friends, family, whatever, but once I kind of think or feel or fear that they're tired of me or, you know, they're done with me, then I do this thing where I push. And, you know, and I know a lot of survivors do this, but it's like a mechanism in us to protect ourselves from getting hurt. And he asked me, we went to a session, and he was like, I don't understand. You know I'm not going anywhere. And literally the words I said is, with everybody in my life, there's always a but. I love you, but. There's always been a but. And he looked at me, and he said, there's no buts here. And matter of fact, he now has a tattoo. It says no buts. The tattoo artist had no idea why he was getting a tattoo like that, but this is the only one he's got.
That's
a tattoo that says no buts.
Talk about validation.
It really was to me, and that was my birthday present he gave me last year. So, or the year before last. My bad. But, yeah, that was my birthday present to me, was to get a tattoo saying no buts.
Oh, that is
so
awesome.
Yes, it is. We've been married 31 years, so I'm really lucky. But I didn't realize until we just kept arguing and fighting that the abandonment and the neglect was such a big thing for me, because – when I thought about my childhood, I didn't necessarily think about the fact that I was abandoned. I just would think about why, what was wrong with me, that they couldn't love me enough to keep me around. And what did I do to make them hate me so much? And was it something I said? And for my mom, she hated my real dad so much that I used to think, okay, you know, I had strawberry blonde hair. I have strawberry blonde hair, and it's from that side of the family. And I used to think, I must look too much like them. You know, maybe she looks at me and all she can see is them, and she hates me because of that. But I can remember growing up just always trying to find a reason why she hated me so much that she couldn't protect me and she couldn't love me and be there for me. And so it's like I look for that in other people, too, of why they must hate me or what I've done that makes them upset with me. And,
let me ask
you, know, that's,
you said your mother, mm-hmm. You said your mother couldn't protect you. Would you use the word wouldn't instead of couldn't? Because couldn't she have if she wanted to?
Absolutely.
You think?
Absolutely. But as a kid, the only thing I could see was that maybe she couldn't. Maybe she did. I feel like as a kid, I wanted to make excuses for her, because every time that I would sit down with her and talk to her about what was going on, she would have excuses. And it wasn't until I started therapy that I realized that I was taking what she told me and living with that as her excuse. It, like, just got embedded in me that, well, you know, she couldn't because of this or that. So it wasn't that she couldn't. She just she wouldn't, and she didn't.
So let's say in your younger years here, we're going to go ahead and we'll talk a lot more about, you know, when you became an adult, started understanding more. But it says here in your, and then it said your mother married a new daddy. So let's hear about your new daddy.
So my new daddy, he was my monster. But, you know, it's kind of like the Little Red Riding Hood story, you know, the big bad wolf is wearing Granny's clothes, and Little Red Riding Hood doesn't see that. She only sees that it's Granny sitting there in the bed. And, you know, it's funny, I kind of related to that story a lot, because that's how I saw my stepfather, who later adopted me. He did not start out mean. He was never abusive to me as far as physically. And he was not verbally abusive to me either. He was very kind. He was loving. He was nurturing. He doted on me. He gave me all the attention a child that's been abandoned would ever want. He was fantastic. And let me tell you, it makes me sick to say that word,
anywhere near him. But he was a great, he was what I needed. And I ate it up. I loved every minute of it, even though he was starting to do things that was uncomfortable before they got married. But all I could see was this man is just, he's giving me all this attention, this affection, and he was doting on me. And literally, he was like he was infatuated with me. And more or less obsessed in a way, looking back. After marriage, it went from being this loving, doting thing to the grooming got to be more and more. And even though it was somewhat forceful, he was still doing it in a loving, tender way to make sure, you know, to make it as normal as possible. You know, mom could be sitting across the living room and he would have me sitting on his lap. And if she would leave to go to the kitchen to get something to drink, he would take advantage of that time to let hands wander. And then she'd come back and sit down. And then, you know, he'd just kind of keep his hands like just close enough. So looking back, I didn't even realize that was grooming until my therapist asked me how I was groomed. And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? What is that? But he did it. He was very clever. You know, I mean, they're con artists. Pedophiles are con artists. And he was very good at his craft and basically, I hate to say, seducing a child. Because he definitely, in his way, seduced me into his world. And I was 6 when they met. I was 7 when they married. And we moved to Texas. We moved out of town, out of state. Sorry. We moved out of state, and we ended up away from all of our family. He had a brother that lived in the same city we moved to, but we had no other family. And so basically we moved in a city where I knew nobody. And he ended up going from just the handsy feeling and messing around to, within the boxes weren't even all unpacked. And he started, if she would go run to the store and I could be outside playing, he would call me inside in the middle of the day to go to the bathroom with him, and he'd have the shower running already, and he'd tell me that I need to take a bath, that I was very dirty, I need to take a bath, and he was dirty too, so he wanted to show me how the correct way to bathe, and he always made it like it was a teaching thing to teach me how to bathe, and I remember he used to think, that's so weird, I think I know how to wash my body by now, but it wasn't anything about getting clean, although that messed with my head for a long time, even still now, that always feeling like a dirty thing because he just, to this day, talk about PTSD, showers, if there's water splattered in my face or, we go boat run with the family sometimes, and for a while they were doing the kneeboarding thing, any water splashing in my face, it gets me completely triggered to the point that I almost can't breathe. And so I've gotten very clever with how I shower. I literally get in the shower and I wash my body, but somehow water never hits my face unless I cup it in my hand, and I always rinse my face that way. It's very methodical and careful. But he would take me to the shower and he would ask me, you know, tell me that he was going to show me how to wash myself. Well, he would start washing me down there. And he, the smell of Ivory soap kills me to this day. But he would take that soap and he would get to digging so deep that it would just start burning. And I would beg him to please stop. You know, it's burning and it's hurting and please stop. And then finally, you know, he would say, well, okay, I'll stop. But the only way you get to rinse the soap off and make sure that you're clean is you got to help me wash now. And that was when he would have me basically masturbate him. And, he didn't always finish on me, but he did often. Showers, it's amazing I take a shower at all anymore, because showers is how it really progressed in the beginning. And I was only 7 years old at that time when that started. When we moved another apartment over in the same city, and then it went to from showers to the games, and it was always
The games were never, like most families have games on their dining room table or their living room coffee table. He always wanted to play on their bed in his bedroom. And it was rarely any kind of games involved. It was just his lure to get me in there. And, you know, anything he could do to lure me in there, you know, like I miss my grandparents terribly because I was so close to them. I was till the day they died. He would tell me, you know, we're going to go write some letters to your grandma and to your grandpa, and why don't you come in here and sit with me, and I'll help you write the letters. And the paper would be there, the pen would be there, but we never ended up writing letters because it went straight to what he wanted me to do for him. You know, and that is when it turned into the masturbation got to be more repetitive. He would have me masturbate him. It took him a while to coax me into he would ask for oral sex by saying he wanted me to kiss it. And it took a long time before he finally got to that because I just, that's when the forcefulness started to play a little piece at a time when I was starting to resist. Because at this point, even though I don't know why it's wrong, I just know it doesn't seem right.
Right. You were very uncomfortable. Let me know what kind of, some of the feelings you were feeling. Were you afraid? Did he threaten you?
So he never threatened me at this point. But the thing is, he was abusive to my mother. He was physically abusive to my mother and verbally abusive to her. You know, it was, he was bipolar. And back then, you didn't hear the word bipolar. You always heard manic depressive. He was manic depressive.
Right.
And he would go into this manic state. And he was also a drug addict and an alcoholic. So it was not a pretty package there, but even when he was sober, you know, it was a constant cycle. He'd go a few years, I wouldn't even say a few years. He would go probably a year, year and a half, of staying on his lithium and stuff like he needed to, and then he decided he didn't need it anymore. He'd start smoking pot or he'd start popping pills or whatever his choice was, and then you could just see the decline quickly when he would start, before he'd get to those points, the abuse got worse with my mom, like, you know, the pushing her around, smacking her upside the head. You know, I've watched him so many times beat the hell out of her, and being that little, all I could do was cry and beg for him to quit hitting her. You know, that's such a horrible feeling to watch your mother get beaten like that and not be able to stop it, can't do a thing, and too afraid to leave her to go tell a neighbor, because I was so scared he was going to do something too far, and yeah, I don't know what I thought I was going to do by just standing there, but, it, you know, I am a, you know, there's fight or flight. I was a freeze. I froze with everything that happened to me. I rarely fought because freeze mode was my way. I just always froze.
How long do you think, how many years was your mother in danger of him? How long did she stay? And why do you think she didn't leave?
You know, that is a $1 million question that I have had a conversation with my therapist a 1 million times. So my brother
I just want to interject. If you don't have an answer or you don't feel comfortable answering, don't feel that you have to be pressured on this, on your story, to tell what you don't feel comfortable or can't share or don't know.
No.
Okay?
I appreciate that. So, okay.
Okay.
When I left home at 16, and I'm saying that very lightly because that's not how that went down. I didn't just get up one day, pack a bag, and leave. My husband was my high school sweetheart, and we were engaged before this all happened. We had been married. We had been dating a year and a half at this point, and I finally it is, you know, and excuse my language when I say this, and I hate it, but the best way I could put that, after the sexual abuse and the rape stopped, the brainwashing and the gaslighting, it was like a daily, I'm going to use it. I'm not going to use that word, but it was like the mind screwing that they did. That's a lighter way to put it. The mind screwing that they did to me, it just had me in this mental warfare constantly, daily. And my husband, boyfriend, fiance at the time, got so fed up with, you know, picking me up for school, and I was just a mental wreck, crying and just beside myself. Because when I walked in that house, I was a mental wreck. When I was with him, I felt like I had some hope. But then it got to where the longer I was living with them and seeing that there is a place to be happy, which was with him, then I'd go home and see misery and feel that. My mind was so messed up. I just couldn't make sense of it. And he finally had it, and one morning he picked me up from home to take me to school. And he said, you know, I can't take this anymore. He said, you know, what do you think about just, you know, eloping? What do you think about just getting married? Let's just run off. Let's get married. And I looked at him, I was like, but you're not done with school. And he goes, I don't care. He goes, you know, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about you. So we ended up, we had this little plan going on, and we were going to leave, and it didn't exactly end that way. I was going to beauty college at the time after school, because my whole plan was to get at least my hair license so that I would have some kind of way to support myself and get out. And he was supposed to come pick me up from beauty college, and instead my mother showed up to pick me up. And that wasn't the plan. I don't know what happened between the night before and that next day, but she ended up picking me up. She's screaming at me, and she's, you know, throwing stuff across the car at me, and I'm just trying to figure out why she's so mad. And this went on all the way to the house. And, you know, when we got to the house, she told me to get inside, and the whole time she is screaming so loud, the veins in her face and her neck was just bulging. And I kept thinking to myself, God, I hope my husband can read my mind right now. Please come get me out of here. And, you know, I was already kind of getting to that point of suicidal ideation because I was just so mixed up. And all I kept thinking is, I can't keep going through this. I'm not going to survive another night of this. Well, apparently my husband decided not to just decide. I wasn't waiting on him, and he showed up at the house, and he literally, long story short of that, is he pulled me out of that house and pretty much drugged me to the truck. And this was with her clawing at his back and pulling his shirt off because he was bending over, and he had claw marks all the way down his back from her. And she was screaming and hollering at him. And
why was she
mad? Protected him all along. So she was a control freak. And she loved my husband until the point that I think she kind of figured out I must have told him something, because his attitude changed toward him. You know, he couldn't stand him anymore.
Right.
And I think my husband's not real good at faking with other people. He's kind of, yeah, she knew it. And so then all of a sudden she hated him. She hated him with a passion. And
Can we stop at this point? You know, we're already 30 minutes into the show, and I want to see about going down the panel. And yeah,
okay.
It goes by fast, didn't I tell you?
Yeah.
So I have just one question, and then I'm going to go down the panel. The question is, you said he started raping you, and then he let others do the same. Who were others? Who were the others?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so there's not a whole lot of detail I can go into with that, but I will say this. I am a dissociative survivor, and I didn't have all the pieces. Part of my PTSD was constant flashbacks and night terrors, and those flashbacks and night terrors were always in the same room. And it was always with men looking at me. Some had themselves exposed. Some of the fragments was with them on top of me, different ones. And the memories came with the feeling and the somatic pain. And for anybody that doesn't understand that somatic pain, as in, you know, literally I would have pain down there from the rapes, and sometimes that would last days, and I didn't understand all this back then, didn't connect all those dots. That came with a great therapist, but so I would have all these dang flashbacks and night terrors and never want to believe that they were mine. So finally, by going into therapy and talking about it and not using coping mechanisms to numb it all away,
right,
they started getting to be more and more, and EMDR kind of helped me start connecting the dots of these dreams, which also made the dreams more constant, and that's when the pieces started coming together and the memories of being in this room with these men. You know, he was a drug addict, and we didn't have a lot of money, and I would just go ahead and say we were poor. And so, you know, I used to always kind of wonder, where did he get the money to go get these drugs? It just didn't make sense. Well, in these memories that I've gotten through the years, even before therapy, and then finally putting them together after therapy and EMDR, I would see the change of hands, you know, things changing hands, whether it was drugs or money. You know, basically he pimps me out. I don't know who these men are. I don't know. And there is one that I'm pretty sure I do, but I don't want to say.
Oh, definitely not. Jennifer, I want to thank you so much. You're doing wonderful at telling your story. I'm very impressed. And I just want you to know that I'm so sorry to do this, and that, you know, your story is similar and so much like our stories, you know. I'm going to bring Penelope on. Penelope, can you talk to Jennifer?
Oh, yes, thank you. I'd love to. And, oh, Jennifer, I agree with Pamela. You're just so articulate, and you're telling your story with just such, I mean, grace for what it is. I know it's a very hard topic to talk about, but, and you have just such a command over, you know, telling your story, and you seem so controlled, and I'm very, very inspired and impressed by that. Just your strength.
Thank you.
It's apparent in the way that you're, you know, going to the details of your earliest years. There's one question that keeps coming to mind, mm-hmm. and that is, well, there was this theme of just abandonment. I mean, the minute that you said your mom as a baby left you in the apartment and went into the service, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's, you know, you were abandoned literally at birth, and all of this, you know, repetitive, you know, the theme of abandonment. And for a mother, you know, I'm a mother. I know Pamela's a mother. I think you said you're a mother. I mean, typically mothers and parents and guardians do not abandon their children and abandon
Correct.
Their babies. And so I'm thinking, and you did mention, by the way, as an aside, that you did stay with your maternal, was it your maternal grandparents where you felt nurtured?
Yes, ma'am. Very, very, okay. Like I always said that they were the parents I didn't get.
Yeah. And so the thing that I'm just somewhat perplexed by, well, I'm just wondering, my question is, you know, your mother's behaviors are certainly interesting, I guess is the word to use, obviously neglectful and abusive, neglectful. I'm just curious if they're following a pattern, if she had experienced some of that in her life. I mean, how did your mother, you know, get to be that mother that abandoned her baby as, you know, as a baby, and then allowed her daughter to be in the presence of her second husband, who obviously, you know, molested her daughter. I mean, we have an intuition about these things, I think, as mothers. We can sense something. We can sense danger. I'm just wondering, what in your mother's history, was there a pattern there? I mean, you know, was this a cyclical? I mean, I'm just wondering, where did it come from, if that makes sense?
So I don't think anything like that happened with my grandparents, but I've asked the same question, and I'll never get an honest answer for her if I was ever to try and talk to her again, because both of them are still living. My father, my birth father, passed away last year, you know, my abuser and my mother, they're still living. And even if I, you know, when I started this journey, I sent her a letter, it was actually supposed to be a letter that I was writing to her
without the intention of mailing, and it ended up being 8 to 10 pages long. It was a lot of anger in that letter. Then I ended up, that was a birthday present to myself that year, is I sent the letter to him and to her, and she did end up, the letter came back. I sent it certified because I just needed to know that she got it, and it got sent back. It was never received. So I almost regrettably reached out to her to get her email to send it to her that way, because I was determined she was getting this for my birthday. And she read it, and all I can say is she's definitely off the deep end, because none of it was coherent. She was not texting me, she didn't have my phone number, but she was emailing me. She was messaging me through my photography page that I used to have. I've since taken it down. She has messaged me on my Facebook page. I finally had to, like, block her, because literally she's in complete denial. I ever told her. She's in complete denial that she knew anything about the rapes. But I can't help but to feel like something in her world had to have happened somewhere, maybe a bad experience with a boyfriend or something, because I would love to know the answer to that, why she would just stand by and let. That's why I used to think that, you know, even as an adult, I would always look back and think, well, maybe she just hated me because I looked so much like my father's side of the family. I have a lot of resemblance to her, but I have the strawberry blonde hair and the fair skin from that side of the family. And I always felt like, you know, maybe that's why she just couldn't support me, because I looked too much like somebody she hated so much. So she hated me too. You know, and that's the only answer I could ever come up with. And I really still to this day don't have an answer any other way. I mean, she stayed with him till my little brother passed away 8 years ago. And it was after his death that she finally left him and divorced him. It took my brother's death for her to finally leave.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you for answering my question. And I think the hardest thing is not having those kinds of answers, I feel. You know, I've walked in very similar shoes to yours, and sometimes having just the information, not that we would ever condone the behavior of the abuse and neglect, but for me to understand its origin helps me to, heal myself, right? To just understand why, where, who, what, when, how, to have
right.
answers to all those pieces together. And well, you don't have those answers, but you're an amazing person in spite of that, which is a testament to how strong you are. And, you know,
thank you for that.
Testament to you.
Absolutely.
So.
Thank you, Penelope.
Thank you, Penelope.
Thank you,
Jennifer. Yeah, I wanted to just add something. Do
sure.
you think that your the monster could have damaged your mother too, to where she couldn't think for herself, or you know what I'm saying? So, you know,
yeah.
it's not an excuse, but
right.
did he monsterize her too?
He, I'm kind of barely starting to scratch at the surface of what he did to her in grooming and conditioning and the fear he instilled in her as to why she stayed and why she tolerated what she did at my expense. My anger with her, this has been a thing that my therapist has worked so hard with me on, and I literally just finally hit my knees with this the Friday before Mother's Day this year, that I've got to address this mom thing, because it is, it's debilitating, you know, it's very debilitating, the why she didn't do more, why she really didn't do anything. She never left him once, not one time when I would tell her what was going on. And the memory that I have of her walking in the middle of a rape, she didn't stop that either. She just walked back out. And what keeps going through my mind is, no matter what, I have two sons, and now I have a granddaughter and a grandson, and I'm here to tell you, I might walk back out of that room, but when I came back, I'm just going to say that man will never be the same. And I cannot imagine just leaving my child knowing that's going on. So we're working on, we have decided, my therapist has been trying to get me to do this, and I'm a little stubborn, and sometimes I try to go my own way because I want to avoid that, and this is a hard subject for me with my mom because I'm more angry with her, even though she's not the one that raped me, and I should be more angry with him. But it's hard as a mother to just not keep circling back to her. But that anger didn't come to me with her as bad and as deep until I finally forgave myself, because for the longest, I decided it was my fault that all these things happened, and I must have wanted it, and I shouldn't have sat on his lap, and, you know, I hugged him too high on his leg. But the truth is, that's what she would tell me, and possibly what he told her as an excuse to why he did these things.
Right. So she might have been indoctrinated by him. I wouldn't understand walking in on the rape, of course, but the part about, did she have a way to take you and go and make a living, or would she have, you know, not been able to afford to, you know, could she work?
And that's another thing that makes it hard for me to understand, because there was many, many years in our life, as if you want to call a family with him in the picture, that he was not the breadwinner. He was in and out of mental hospitals. The drug addiction and the alcoholism would rear its ugly head. He would be out of jobs. He would lose jobs. And so she was the one that was having to be the breadwinner to fill in the gaps. And so looking back as the adult that had to do it for our family, you know, me and my husband both worked together, she could have done it because she did it anyway. She wasn't, her excuse to me was, well, you just don't, she literally told me, you just don't know what it's like to be a single mom. And that was her excuse for not leaving him. And this was when I was 13 years old, telling her once again what was going on when she was pissed off because I was failing miserably the seventh grade, you know. And it's like, how do you expect me to study and retain anything when this is still going on? And her words to me was, well, you just don't understand what it's like to be a single mom, but I'm going to get you help. And I remember thinking that day, her telling me she's going to get me help was like she was saying that it was me that was the crazy one and me that was sick and not him. That stuck with me a long time too. It's funny the different things that she said to me that has just been burned in my brain all these years, but that's a big one.
Right. Well, my mother was a very narcissistic woman. I mean, so unfeeling and uncaring about her children. And it sounds like to me she may have been a narcissist. That's just my opinion.
I'm
going to go down to Kirsten in Texas. I'm sorry, Kirsten, and the panel that I've waited so long to come down to you. But, Kirsten, you're on with Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for being so vulnerable with sharing your story.
Hi.
I think you're so brave, and I'm so inspired by you. I got on right when I got the text, I got on the call, and I've been listening, and I wanted to actually ask you, how old were you when your memories started coming up to the surface? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how old were you in your adult years?
Okay, so I married when I was 16, and when I got out of the house, I started having like crazy nightmares. Like I would wake up almost jumping out of the bed, crying, and my husband would just hold me until I went back to sleep. And I never want, you know, he didn't force me to tell him, but it was the men in the room. We call it the men in the room. It was the nightmares about the men in the room. And I just couldn't believe, like, where's this coming from? Well, whenever that kept coming back, I begged him to start having kids because, hey, what better way to get over your past than to have a child, right or wrong? That's literally what we did. We had a child, and
You know, the way I put it is my husband saved me from that house and my children saved me from myself. You know, that once the kids got to where they didn't need me as much, they weren't quite as dependent. And probably around 25 years old, the flashbacks and the night terrors started up again, but I wouldn't say anything to even my husband about it because it just seemed crazy to just all of a sudden, oh my gosh, this is bothering me, because society tells us that, you know, we should move on and it's all in the past and let it go. You know, we've all heard these cliche things, and I would even say it too. But then the more every year after about 24, 25 years old, it was like really, it was toxic for me to the point that I had somatic pain so bad. I kept going back to my gynecologist because I thought I was having female problems. And he ran every test. We tried every medicine. The long story short of that is 2 years later, I ended up having a hysterectomy that did not solve the problem and probably shouldn't even have a hysterectomy. I'm not blaming the doctor. He only did what he thought would help, but it did not. It did not stop what was going on. Getting into my 30s, you know, I lived a double life. I really did. My coping was in behaviors. So I would just keep myself ridiculously busy and, you know, involve myself in other people's, either their problems, like always trying to fix somebody else's world and anything I could do to ignore mine. But then, oh my gosh, when Empty Nest came, when my oldest son moved out, it started kind of really snowballing because when he moved out, my youngest son also started high school. And what do high school boys do? You know, they get in their own world and they want to do their thing. So it was like he was living at home, but he wasn't because, you know, he was just being his own little self. And so then it was allowing me to have too much spare time, if that makes any sense. And the mind was just going crazy. Well, then after he moved out, it steadily just kept getting more recurrent, like driving down the road. I had went through suicidal fantasizing, like driving down the road because, and I wouldn't even understand why I was wanting to commit suicide. I just knew I was miserable. I was miserable with myself. And I would drive down the interstate and I would be pegging that truck as fast as it would go and looking at the trees and taking my seatbelt off, just looking to see which tree I was going to just impale myself into. And yet, feeling guilty because here I am with two boys and a husband that would have been devastated. And I always had, when I would have these moments, I had these little, this maternal voice in my head that would tell me, you know, you can't do this. You will be destroying everybody else's life by destroying yours.
Yeah.
But finally, whenever, you know, we had a flood in 2016, we had a historical flood and, through all the stress and everything going on, one of my big coping skills was spending. I was a compulsive spender, and needless to say, you know, credit cards caught up with me. My husband found out, and he insisted I had to go get help, and that was a hard step to take. But when I walked into that therapist's office, I went in there with the "I have a shopping addiction," and when they tried to touch on the whole childhood thing, I did everything I could to not talk about it because I had already decided that wasn't my problem. And then once we got to digging into it, I realized, yeah, that was my problem.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. Wow.
Isn't she very articulate? And just the story, I can't tell you how much of a storyteller you are. Even though we hate that you went through all that, it's just, you know, it's like I'm watching a movie as you're talking, you know.
A book right now, so that kind of helps a little bit, too.
Yeah, it does. It means you're processing. Doug?
Yes, major.
Doug? I'm going to put Doug back on mute. Sometimes Doug
has to keep processing before he can speak. Okay, let's go to Roberta in Oklahoma. Roberta, you're on.
Hello.
Jennifer.
Hello, I'm Roberta. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, Roberta. Hi.
I'm a Oklahoma City. I just moved back here last August, and I came back to the area where I went through a lot of abuse and trauma for, you know, it started in my early childhood, and I tell you, I've been getting them anxiety attacks, that's for sure. But, I started having nightmares when I was, like, probably 7 or 8 years old, but I never did really know why I was having them, and now I'm back in the area where I started having them, and, you know, and I don't know, it's just, you know, sometimes things can't be processed until they're time to be processed, you know, like memories or
right.
feelings and emotions and things like that. And I'm not pushing it, but I'm learning that I don't have to be afraid of it. And it's nice to know to hear other people's stories, you know, that when they go through things, because I went through abuse in all different kinds of households, but a lot of different family members and a lot of different households. And then whenever I was... got in my teenage years, I totally rebelled and just was trusting anybody and everything for everything, and my life really got messed up. But no, it's much
right.
better now. But at least I'm willing to face whatever does get revealed and come up. But it's nice to hear other people's stories and I have a hard time forgiving. Sometimes it's like, oh, everything's fine, I'll talk to you, you know, no matter if it has to do with killing, kidnapping, raping, and we're friends, I love you, and, you know, and then it's like at night when I'm saying my prayers, I'm saying, why did I say that? You know, it's like, these are killers, kidnappers, and rapists. These are killers, kidnappers, and rapists, you know, why should I even have any contact with them at all, you know?
Right.
Even if they are family, you know? And so, that's what I'm experiencing right now. But it's nice to know that you can go through things. And I'm not going to say I'll ever be, like, triumphant and on top of everything and everything, you know, but I can say that I'll be able to manage my life and manage these anxiety attacks and post-traumatic stress I have.
Well, Roberta,
and it's not just,
we're so glad that you're getting on top of your feelings and processing and progressing in your journey.
It helps to hear other people's stories, you know, to know that other people have gone, you know, that are going through things. And it's nice to hear Jennifer's story. And I didn't get in on the very first of it because I came in late, but I apologize for that. But I'm just really glad that I survived as long as I have. And it is good to be honest, no matter how scary it is sometimes, it's best to be honest, and that's what I'm learning to be now, honest with myself and others and truthful, and that's what I have to be. So it's not just family-related things. It has to do with certain organizations and employers, too, and doctors and things like that.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
Thank
anyway,
you,
that's
Roberta.
All I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to get back to Jennifer's story. Jennifer, we only have about 36 minutes left. Can you believe it?
Wow.
I know, it goes by fast, didn't I tell you? Okay, back to your story. Said you escaped Hell House and you married. Then, of course, you talked
mm-hmm.
about your nightmares and somatic stuff, and then you talked about your kids grew up. But then it said when you started in therapy, you learned you had DID. Can you tell us what DID is?
It is dissociative identity disorder. And this right here, for me to say this out loud on something that is national, is a huge milestone for me. When the abuse was going on, as a child, God has given us this gift that our brain will protect us. A rape victim that's an adult will dissociate. Well, a child, it goes, not for all children, but the younger the abuse, neglect, whatever starts, the more prone they are to becoming DID, because for me it started in my years of development. So basically when his abuse came in, it kind of set it off to the point that different authors got stuck at different ages. So, you know, I have authors that I call them my littles. And I have two teens, and I have what I call my elders. And I mentioned earlier when I was telling the other lady about the maternal voice, the maternal voice is what I call my guardian. She literally, at a young age, I can remember like hearing a maternal voice in my head singing to me, or like comforting me, you know, telling me that it's going to be okay, that, you know, it's going to be okay, we're going to get through this, and I'm going to help you. And then next thing I know, everything's over with. And that's because she would help me to basically dissociate. It was like she would come and take me out of the situation so I didn't have to feel the pain. And a lot of people, they hear that and they're like, oh my gosh, this woman's crazy, because I admit it sounds crazy. And when I first heard those words uttered to me, I broke out crying and I asked my therapist, tears flowing, am I crazy? And he looked at me and he just, as sincerely as could be, said, no, you're not crazy. He said, your brain just protected you from terrible, terrible things that were done to you. So I used to, in the beginning of this, look at it as kind of a curse, because as a child, it's a blessing. But as an adult, for me, it's all girls. I know some DID systems have the opposite sex for some of their authors. For me, they're all girls. They're all basically different versions of me. And they have all been, each one of them has been through their own part of the abuse. So they hold parts of my story. And so what happened when I was having these flashbacks, and the reason it was so hard to believe that it was mine, is because it was always like from floating above looking down, and it would seem like it was somebody else there, and yet sometimes that person laying in that bed and that stuff going on is looking at me, and I know that's my body, but I know that I'm not laying there with that body, and I just see it happening knowing that it is. Well, when the memories start coming back and the girls start giving me their stories, the somatic pains kick in, and I have coughing asthma, which is an odd thing to have. A lot of people have wheezing asthma. I have coughing asthma. When I'm triggered, I start coughing a lot. I will start having issues with the somatic pains. I'll get massive headaches, and breathing becomes shallow. You know, it's a PTSD on steroids. It's, you know, completely different, because these girls are giving me their stories, and they're mine. It's like you're watching a movie in a slide. Sometimes it's a slideshow kind of thing, and sometimes it's like watching little mini clips of a movie. And so through EMDR, we've been able to kind of put their stories together, and I've actually finally formed a timeline, because I didn't have a timeline for a long time. I couldn't tell you what city I lived. Like, I could tell you what city I lived in, but not what age I was, not what the school names were. I couldn't tell you the names of any of my teachers, friends. I mean, everything was a blur, and that was why, because these authors were taking over my life to protect me. And there's so much to just the dissociative side of my story that an hour and a half wouldn't get it. I am so grateful that I am. I'm so grateful that I am DID. I wasn't in the beginning. I was actually completely on board with integration. A lot of people think that everybody should just integrate, and to be honest, I want them to share with me, you know, the grief that they went through, the betrayals, the hurt, the pain. I want them to share, because they deserve their peace. They saved me, and I owe them that. So integrating, I never want to see happen until they feel they want to do it and if they want to do it. I am perfectly fine. My husband, what's that?
That's amazing. I love that.
So, and even my husband, he's familiar with them too. You know, he has had conversations with the littles, and it's kind of funny sometimes because I know he feels like I'm looking at my wife and here's this child talking to me. So it's strange, but, you know, it's the funny thing is when he went to therapy with me, I was so scared after my therapist. We did the assessments and everything because he had already suspected, but he wanted to make sure, and then we did the assessments, and it was still a little while before he told me. I was so scared of telling my husband because I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I just felt like I'd already disappointed him so much with just different things that, you know, I wasn't so great with in my own coping ways that I was making him pay the price. I thought, man, this is going to be it. So I asked him to go to therapy with me to break the news, quote unquote. And we were sitting there and I sat there for the longest pause, and then finally my therapist was like, so are you going to say it or do you want me to tell him? And I said, no, I'll tell him. And I told him that, you know, it was the idea. And my husband was like, okay. After I explained what it was, he was like, okay. And I kind of looked at him like, that's weird. That's a weird reaction. And my therapist, he says, do you understand what that is? And he goes, yeah, she's got other personalities. And he says, so are you not shocked? And he says, I'm not shocked at all. I was like, oh, wow. I was so worried that he was going to be like, oh, she's got to go. She's just too crazy for me. And he embraced it. There's been a lot for him to understand. And, it you know, it's been a learning curve. But, you know, it's much better now that that's all in the open with us and for both of us, you know, me knowing and him knowing as well.
Well, I was looking at my psychopathology book today, and I found a sensitive disorder in here, and I did not know that PTSD is the umbrella over, you know, subtypes, which the idea is one of. And there was a case history in here, Emily, and the therapist said to Emily, she was recounting the nightmares that they usually had a pattern that they were connected to her father coming into her room at night, touching her in secret places. I tell my mother, but she just laughed and said, Emily, you just have a vivid imagination. You know, I've never let anybody hurt you. She used to tell me that's why we put you in a mental institution, because you remember things that never happened. And then the therapist went on and said, shifting the subject, I asked Emily if she ever found items of clothes, jewelry, or other things that she didn't recognize. She looked at me and said, how did you know that? She said, yeah, once I found some motorcycle stuff in my closet. And what happened was she had an actual male alter named Rick. And then she had another alter named Frank. I know. And so Emily was considered the host person, and it says here that the host usually seeks help, but the host usually isn't very aware of the other alters. But, you know, in your case, you are. That doesn't mean everybody's not.
Well, I am now. I am now, and only because it was through a lot of work. I mean, sometimes it was through others dragging me uphill because, you know, I tried so hard to discount it because nobody wants this. I shouldn't say nobody, but who wants to say, oh, great, I got this. And you know, I hate that it's called dissociative identity disorder. It's an injury. Literally, this is not something you're born with. This is not genetic in the DNA. This is something that happens because of constant yeah. abuse starting at a young age. And
well, let me clarify.
So, yeah, I wasn't aware, but.
Let me clarify why it's called a disorder, because
mm-hmm.
a disorder is something that does not, and this is from my social work learning, a disorder is something that doesn't have enough elements to it to be called a disease, okay? So that's why it's called
right.
a disorder.
And I get that.
And that's
it's just, you know.
Yeah. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, calling it that because they don't think that it's that important. It's called that to differentiate for mental health professionals what they're dealing with. Exactly.
Right, right.
So,
go ahead.
Well, did your dissociative disorder, working through that, do any of your alters, are they the ones that are angry with your mother? I mean, don't you have to figure out who it is exactly who's angry with her before you can deal with that?
Oh, yes. And it can be really complicated because, for instance, with the mother, the littles love her. You know, children have an unconditional love. And no matter how many times she walked out, no matter how many times she left them behind, they always love her and they would see her as the mother they had and they would only see the good. They would always look past the other. So still, even today, as I sit here and tell you this story, I'm trying to get them to see that she was not a good mother. She did not protect us. She should have done better. She could have done better, but she didn't. And because of her, this continued. She can't help that it happened to begin with, but she can help that it continued as long as it did. So for me, that is hard with them. And you know, I have the youngest alter, she's 5, and she's the one that holds all the neglect and the abandonment, you know, the being left behind. And she is the one that clings to the mom she thought she had, the mom that would come in and show her off for everybody. And even though she was invisible behind closed doors, she chose to remember that. Well, then there's the 7-year-old that, you know, she remembers her mom fixing her hair for her in the morning. And just and even though there's not many memories, they hang on to that because it's what they got, and what they got, they make it big. So it's just like they cast all the other stuff off as far away as they can. And the fault kind of – I hate to say fault. Let me not say fault. Guardian is the one that's protected them so much from so much of the abuse that they did not have to endure most of the worst stuff. You know, the stuff with the men in the room, they weren't in there for. The little bit they were, it wasn't for long. I have 2 elder alters that are sisters, and they were the ones that were there for the men in the room. They took the most brutal part of the abuse, and not going to get into that any deeper, but they are the ones that are very angry. And for a while there, when I was doing my unpacking of trauma, those two, like in the beginning when I started seeing my alters, I saw the one, she was very dark, she was very angry, and she almost looked demonic. But then once we started unpacking that story, then she came into this really bright, now she, instead of being a persecutor, she is my protector. You know, those two have held so much anger with my mom not doing anything to protect, and then they have anger with men in general, so it doesn't take much for them to get ticked off with a man. So for a while there, while they were unpacking, it was creating problems in my with my husband, because he would say just one wrong word and then they were off, and it would be a hard switch. And you know, he finally started recognizing it, and he would call him out on it. And that was finally, he just kind of loved them through it, and you know, promised that he was never that person and would never do anything like that, and don't put him in that category. And
It's complex. Right. It's a very complex thing. But every author has a different thing.
You are extremely good at sharing this, because I'm really starting to think many more people have this and aren't really aware of it, and they just like put it under the rug, like denial, right?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. But I lived in denial for years, so yeah.
Yeah. I can hear in your story of healing how you've got this kind of all down to a science, you know, and it makes perfect sense. One of the questions I would ask you is, these children with the unconditional love, are you going to have to take that element of their unconditional love away? I mean, for them to get, I mean, are you going to replace it with anger, or how's that going to work for the five-year-old?
That's an interesting question. That's a very interesting question. So the weekend at the, you know, I Friday after Mother's Day, you know, my therapist pointed out to me that that Friday prior to Mother's Day, that I literally drove around town for the whole day, crying my eyes out. And Mother's Day's always been a mixed emotion for me. You know, a lot of it's because of the fact that she wasn't there for me. And then not to mention, the first time I told her about it was on Mother's Day, coming back home from church. So it's kind of a traumaversary. And, you know, the littles, the, you know, two of them felt very betrayed, because literally it started out this explosive argument to this muted conversation, and then them in the bedroom giggling and the sounds of them having sex and talking. And it's like, the worst day of my life, the scariest day of my life, you know, because I contemplate telling her about this for weeks after seeing an awareness poster at school, and finally tell her, and then she literally just, she doesn't leave him, she doesn't remove me, she just goes to the room, and that's it, that's the end of it, and tells me to go to my room and go to bed. So I went to bed feeling like I did something wrong, and needless to say, that led into him coming in the room later and more or less very aggressively sexually assaulting me, to the point of bleeding, to let me learn a lesson for being dramatic and trying to get attention. And so that's the kind of stuff that, I hate to say it, I feel like they were very careful in what pieces we give them of that, because they're amnestic of a lot of that, but we're trying to give it to them to the point they'll just disappear on me again, because they'll go into hiding, and if they go into hiding, I can't help them.
Okay.
So we're trying to be delicate with them, but we are starting with the littles first, is the plan me and my therapist came up with. We're starting with them first, and we're going to go from the youngest and go to the oldest, and get the healing and the recognition that, you know, she was not, the way he put it was that we always looked at her being the only mother we got, you know, and that's the best we could get, and in his words, and it stuck with me. We could have gotten better. That is not the best she could have been.
Right. Let's kind of shift from the sad part, and the, you know, because it's been sad and it's been bad. I kind of want to get into number one, and we only have like 15 minutes left. So I would like to know two things. I would like to close with two things, and we'll try to go to the picture. But number one is what's number one? Number one is, tell us briefly how you found this specialist, because there are not a lot of people out there dealing with DID right now. Okay, you're laughing. You got a story. Go ahead.
It was an accident. So I was going to a different therapist. It was a woman, because I swore I'd never go to a man. And I was, like I said, I went in with this, I have a shopping addiction.
And so I, because my husband, he had put his foot down, you're getting help and there's no getting out of it. And he said, you need to find somebody that can help with the shopping addiction you got. So, okay, that's what I did. Well, there's nothing in a phone book or, well, there's no phone books anymore, but there's nothing online for a shopping addiction. So I'm looking and I'm like, well, addiction's addiction. So I'll go to an addiction counselor, and I found one, and I'm glad I went to this place because I was only in there. This is PTSD on steroids again, but I was only in there with her unpacking the shopping and the addictions. And, like, she had pulled all kind of information she could about shopping addictions. She was scratching her head. She was a chemical addiction counselor, not a shopping addiction counselor. So she was trying to do what she could. Well, then finally she started asking me questions about my childhood. As soon as we barely scratched the surface, because I didn't have shopping that I could go do anymore, I didn't have kids to raise to keep me busy. I was no longer, I retired from my salon. I quit doing that because my body gave out on me. And I was going through this all raw, facing it head on, you know, walking through that fire. And I went from having low blood pressure my whole life to all of a sudden I've got high blood pressure, I'm having anxiety attacks, and just going into crisis mode at the drop of a hat. Well, I didn't realize that's what it was. I thought I was about to have a heart attack. And after several weeks of it, I told my sister-in-law. She was in there one day when I was, like, hanging onto my chest, and she was like, oh, my God, what's wrong? And I said, I think I need to go get checked. And I called. We have a cardiologist already. So I called him and I was like, I need to come in. I'm not going to an emergency room. I want you to see me. So I literally walked myself into a very busy cardiologist's office, and I ended up having a heart cath done because I had a false positive on all my testing. And turned out didn't have any blockages, which was good. But he was like, you know, you have high blood pressure. We're going to start giving you medicine. But I'm like, high blood pressure? I've always had low blood pressure. Still not connecting the dots. When I went back to therapy after a couple weeks and getting, you know, recouped, she says, so I have something to tell you. She says, I'm not going to be able to see you anymore. And I was like, wait, what? I had just hit a point. I just told her enough that I was just like, I couldn't imagine starting with somebody else. She says, so I'm referring you to somebody that is trained in trauma, and he is trained in people like you that's been sexually abused as a child. And at this point, tears are just rolling down my face because, of course, at this point, I feel rejected. I feel like she's literally just rejecting me, and she's sending me to a man. So I'm just steadily crying, feeling rejected, and not hearing half of what she said. But then the one thing she did say is, you know, we've only scratched the surface. And, you know, I feel like you'd be in better hands with him. And I feel like he could help you way more than me. I'm not qualified for what you need. And I was like, okay, I just got rejected. And the first time I walked in that office to see him, A, it's a man. B, I got rejected. And as soon as he walked out, I excused myself to the bathroom and had a complete meltdown, borderline psychotic meltdown, because I did not want to walk back into his office. I did not. But I pulled it together because, you know, I used to wear my mask very well, but he tells me now he saw right through it. But when I walked back in that office, I sucked it up and I kept my chin up and I was trying to say all the right things and I was trying to, again, not go into the child sex abuse. I literally ended up with him kind of by accident. I started with one and she sent me to him, and I've been with him since, and I thank God for it. It was a godsend that, you know, I ended up with him, because I don't know that anybody, I've been to other people in the past trying to get help, and all they did was make it worse for me. So he's definitely good. I don't know if he was a DID specialist, but he was definitely very familiar with it and educated in it. So I can't say that, you know, I don't know that he was, but I don't know anybody else that knows as much as he does. You know, I mean, he definitely knows the ins and outs of it.
You've probably
taught
him a lot. Taught him a lot.
I probably did. And he's even told me that having me has taught him things that even in the classes he goes, you know, the whatever you call them for his hours or whatever that is, that my situation is not even necessarily along the line of what they are. And he says that, you know, I've taught him things that they don't teach. So, yeah, I guess I have taught him along the way. But either way, he's definitely brought me a long, long way, and I'm very grateful for it. And
okay, I want to.
He just can't go nowhere for a long time.
We've got less than 10 minutes. I want to tell the audience that you say healing is messy, and I'm still healing is messy, and I'm still healing, but I've achieved some major milestones so far, and want every survivor out there to know that it's all worth it. Now, for the rest of the time, about 5 minutes, I want you to talk about Little Jen's Voice Facebook page. Little Jen's Voice Facebook page.
Okay. Little Jen's Voice for Dissociative Survivors. I've been on the page since 2016, and it is actually how I broke my silence. I broke my silence on that page, but it was only after I finally, my kids never knew what I went through, and when I sent the letters to my abuser and mother, I knew that I needed to tell them for fear that they might try to reach out to my kids because that's how they function. So I sat down in a room with them, told them, very hard to do, but that was a huge milestone. I'm glad I did it. I hate it sometimes that they know as much as they do, because exposure is hard for me. But then Little Jen's Voice has been amazing for me therapeutically, as well as I've had so many reach out to me through the years telling me that I helped them to see that they definitely still need help, or I've had a few reach out saying that they realized they were DID by reading my post. And I don't even really get hard and heavy on DID because my philosophy is I did not know I was DID until I started therapy. And some people, I feel like if somebody would have told me that before going to therapy, I'd have never went to therapy. I'd have been like, nah, that's for crazy people. I'm not going to do it. So on my Little Jen's page, I really try to focus on that. And I have a blog, littlejensvoice.org. That I do weekly blogs, and I give pieces of either my therapy, what I'm doing in my healing journey, or, you know, what I struggle with, PTSD, somatic memories, which hardly anybody really talks about and should be. The fact that you can be decades before remembering like me, and that, you know, using your voice, the biggest reason why it's Little Jen's Voice is using your voice is empowering, and I want to pay that forward because I started that page and I broke my silence because my best friend's daughter was sexually abused in the church, and she broke her silence on there, and she is the same age as my youngest son, and I thought if that girl can do it, I surely can sit here and do this as a 40-something-year-old woman. And so it's just giving me fire over and over. Now, especially having grandchildren, it's just giving me a fire to just be a voice for the voiceless, the ones out there that's too scared to talk.
Okay, so I'm going to go to the panel, and we're going to say, you know, good night and whatever comments the panel has. I want to first thank you for coming on, Jennifer. You've been a real enlightenment. You've really enlightened us. And I just want to thank you for that. But you're on with Penelope now.
Thank you, Pamela. Jennifer, I mean, let me just tell you, we talked a little before the show. Can I say A+? I mean, you are incredible, inspiring. You sound very confident. And I'm just thankful that you came on tonight. I think we all learned something, a little something from your story. I think a lot of us, I could personally relate to a lot of it.
I think you've really bravely, you know, continued and opened up the dialogue more with DID. So I just really want to say cheers to you, and I hope, you know, once you get off the call tonight, this 90-minute show, that you just have a big smile on your face and you're very proud of, you know, coming on this evening and what you've shared, because I know that's how I'm going to end the call. So thank you for being
well, thank
new.
You. Well, my little secret to that, though, is I literally had a tear fest right before I got on the phone with y'all, so don't give me too many props. I was crying before we got on the phone.
Well, you deserve them all, though. You really, truly do, in my humble opinion.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. If you're part of the NASCA family now, you'll never be alone. You have us.
That's right.
I'm going to bring Kirsten on from Texas. Kirsten, you're on with Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm just, like, really sitting here. I just have a lot of mixed different emotions because I see so much of your story in myself. And, you know, I've been in therapy and EMDR myself, and I was sitting in my therapist's office on Monday this week saying, like, I don't know how old each of, you know, how old they are. And I feel like I'm supposed to know, like, how old each one is. And I don't know. I'm just, like, at the very beginning of this, and it's complicated. Anyway, I just want to thank you. I want to thank Little Jen, too. I think your voice is amazing, and so thank you so much for sharing. It means so much.
Uh-huh. Thank you for saying that. It means a lot. And and good luck with that. Are you DID?
I'm pretty sure I am. I mean, like,
okay.
My therapist
takes time.
Put that on, you know, she hasn't, I don't find it as an offensive label per se, but I just,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure that, I mean, my abuse started at a very young age on up until I was 8 years old, from like one to like eight. So anyway, so I just want to thank you, and your voice means a lot. So thank you for sharing tonight.
Well, thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kirsten. Okay, Doug and Marilyn, would you say a supportive comment to Jennifer, please? Okay, Doug. I know you're there, and we care about you so much. Okay, Jennifer, it's time to end the show, but we really appreciate you coming on. And
thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
I think we all shed tears tonight. Okay, leave the audience with a nugget. Just leave them with something.
So I will say, use your voice. Don't be afraid. You can't believe the lies has been told to you your whole life. They're not true. They want you to believe that because they know your voice has so much power. And if you don't use your voice, you're letting them win. And I'm even using that voice now. I'm writing a book because I refuse to let them win, and I will keep talking until I am in the ground. Doesn't matter. I will never stop talking. I will always use my voice.
We love you, Kirsten, from the NASCA family. I mean, we love you, Jennifer. But we love everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Even when Pamela makes mistakes, we still love her. All right. Penelope, sign us off, please.
Well, I just want to say, Jennifer, Kirsten, Pamela, Doug, everybody out there, we thank you for being on the show with us this evening. You know, we salute Jennifer for her courage, and as we always say in the show with NASCA, as adults, we all have a responsibility to keep our children safe. So if you see something, you have to say something.
Thank you and good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Blog Talk Radio.